This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Minns.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zielinski.
G'day, Diplomates fans. Welcome back to the show. So much going on in the world of geopolitics. Unbelievable amount. It's actually impossible to keep up. So this week, I got Hagar Shamali back on the show. We cover off a heap of issues. US midterms, Trump is running, is he going to win, is he not going to win? Ukraine, the victories in Kherson, Russia's attacks, including what's happened in Poland, is that going to trigger World War III? We've got the G20, Biden and Xi, we've got Albanese and Xi, we've got the protests in Iran, COP27 and climate change, what's happening with the World Cup, and also Elon Musk and Twitter. So enjoy the episode. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we've got another couple of big interviews to drop before the end of the year, so keep your eyes peeled for those. Thanks so much for everybody who's been following my work in Ukraine. Thank you for your support of Ukraine and Ukrainians. I really appreciate your personal support, so keep following that conflict as much as you can. It really does make an important difference to the morale and spirit of Ukraine's the support that they're getting from places like Australia and those of you listening around the world in the United Kingdom, Europe, and the US. So thank you once again. Without further gibbering from me, enjoy the episode. Hagar, welcome back to Diplomate. So good to see you. How are you?
So good to see you, my friend. I'm great. Thank you for having me. Huge time zone difference right now between you and me.
Oh, look, I mean, I'm so used to operating across so many different time zones over the last year that, it doesn't really matter at this point. Sleep is for the weak, and as long as you're getting good conversations with people, it's all that matters, right?
That's fair. I can't even do the math right now. I'm in New York. It's 5 p.m. my time.
It is 9 a.m. It's 9 a.m. here in Sydney. So, all right. Well, let's rip right in. So much to cover as always, even just the last 24 hours has been hectic. But I think we can't, you're in the United States. We can't talk about the world without talking about planet America. We've had the midterms on the weekend. And then yesterday we've had the former president of the United States announcing his candidacy for the 2024 election. So Donald Trump, welcome back to the show. Not that he ever left. Now let's start with the basic. Trump going to win, yes or no?
Oh, no. Oh, I don't. Not only do I not think he'll win, I don't even think he'll be the Republican nominee.
Right. I actually agree with you. Let's just unpack that a little. Like, why do you say that he's not going to be? And then we'll maybe talk a little about the midterm results as well.
You know, in the months running up to his announcement that he'd be running again in 2024, he had already become a liability and very toxic. And you saw this conflict within the Republican Party of whether or not his endorsements in the run-up to the midterm elections, which we just had. So those are the elections for our senators and representatives for our Congress. And there was a lot of debate as to whether his endorsements were helpful or harmful. And the proof of that was in the elections we just had. And the proof really was that in large part, except for basically one candidate he endorsed, he was proven to be toxic and certainly not the kingmaker that he made himself out to be. And so that's a big part. But now also he is going toe-to-toe with a beloved leader in the GOP, in the Republican Party, Ron DeSantis. He's the governor of Florida. And now he's gone after him. Trump has gone after him because he sees him as a threat.
Well, and, that's interesting, right? He's calling him. I actually think there's a projection of weakness there again, where if you're the strongest candidate, you don't worry about others as much. So his obsession with DeSantis, but even also just calling him De Sanctimonious kind of misses the mark for me. Like, Trump's pretty good at nicknaming people, low energy Jeb, Little Marco, Crooked Hillary. These nicknames tend to stick, but De Sanctimonious just feels lame, for lack of a better word. So
lame and doesn't, and is even, by the way, from a PR standpoint, which is what a lot of my background when I was spokesperson in government, from a marketing standpoint, is a dumb nickname. And it doesn't, it just does him no good. And you, so you see a lot of Republican leaders starting to distance themselves from him. And I think that we're going to see more and more of that as the months go on.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because looking at the midterm results, so there was this so-called expectation of a red wave. As it turns out, red trickle or red something. The Democrats have now held their majority in the Senate, have picked up one seat, maybe it might be an additional seat, depending on what happens in the Georgia runoff. The House will probably go to the Republicans on a very, very narrow basis. So it's interesting. The number one no-no in politics globally, but US politics, is look, it doesn't, it didn't appear to matter what Trump did. He could offend anyone. He could be chaotic. He could incite a riot. He could deny elections. But what you can't have is losing. And now Donald Trump, for the fact that he won in 2016, you know, a lot of people focus on that. But what the truth of the matter is, he's actually lost for his party the last three elections, the 2018 midterms, the 2020 presidential, which he did lose, as we know, and now the 2022 midterms, where he's cost, you know, probably a thumping majority. You know, when you look at what the, even just history will tell you that the incumbent president does poorly. And Biden had a lot of headwinds in terms of his own approval ratings, you know, hovering around the 40% mark, inflation being a high number, gas and groceries being a killer of governments anywhere. And somehow the Democrats have had the best midterm results since the 1960s, since JFK. And so quite extraordinary to manage that. And so Trump, despite all his brand around being a winner, is actually now a loser. And I think there's the biggest shift. But do you think it'll be DeSantis? Because I actually don't think it will be. But I'm curious about, if it wasn't Trump, who do you think would be the candidate?
I think it would be between DeSantis and Governor Abbott of Texas is what I'm looking at. What are you thinking?
Well,
I think, because let me tell you something. But after the pandemic, governors played a much larger role than ever. And so all of a sudden they're on the political scene in a much bigger way. And so a lot of the banter you hear in Washington is that the next election is definitely about governors. Right. And I could see why. I could see why they think that. But I don't think that that's... I don't think it's a shoe-in for them, but that's why I'm kind of picking these two as going toe-to-toe.
Well, I think, I mean, there's an interesting, not to get into the inside baseball of this, one of the problems that the Republicans have is if a lot of candidates get in, it might be 2016 all over again. And if you assume Trump, even if he doesn't have a majority of Republican voters, if he has a large cohort or a plurality, say he has 30% as a hard number, it's a winner-takes-all primary system. So if you have 20 people in and you've got 30%, that's actually quite good for Trump. So that's a problem. They're looking at changing the rules, and they may do that to some degree, but that is interesting. But I actually think I agree with you on governors. I actually think Glenn Youngkin might be one to watch. I think Virginia guy, I think he's untainted by a lot of the Trumpy stuff. So he's relatively clean skin. I also just think front runners don't tend to win. You know, the last time going into 2016 – there was a front runner from Florida by the name of Jeb Bush with $100 million who tanked.
That's true.
And so, you know, I think him, Larry Hogan, maybe, you know, Chris Sununu, but I agree with you around governors. So Abbott is another one to watch. Now, just zooming out a little, how does this change US policy on a global front? Does it change it at all? Yeah, because there was a little bit of a streak coming, then we'll talk about Ukraine in a second, but I want to talk about US approach to Ukraine and just to the world. You know, talk of hardliners coming into Congress against, you know, American policy towards China, but then also funding of Ukraine and skepticism around that. How do you see these midterms impacting on that?
So I'm glad you asked this, because I think, so there are two aspects to your question, as I see it, that are different and related in some way. But to answer your first part, I don't see much of a change when it comes to U.S. foreign policy toward, for example, China or Iran or the Ukraine war or anything like that with the changes that you're seeing in Congress. And that's honestly, by the way, because on one hand, you're not seeing a huge shift. Yes, the Republicans are taking the House, but not the Senate. And I just don't expect much to change, because from Trump to Biden, except for Iran, you didn't see a huge shift, for example, in terms of pushing back on China. You didn't see a huge shift in in sanctions policy, you saw a greater focus on alliances, right, for sure. But on the grand scheme of things, when it comes to addressing national security threats, and this is as a rule, by the way, Democrats and Republicans tend to agree often on the end goal, just the means sometimes will change and vary a little bit. But I don't see a lot of change there coming up, and certainly not as it relates to Ukraine. I think there's a lot of strong support in bipartisan support in supporting Ukraine and pushing back against Russia. What I think is interesting, and you could look at this glass half full or glass half empty, is we're seeing in the United States and around the world this rising far right sentiment. And although you have the left winning, they won in the United States now, they won in Brazil recently, they won in Australia over the summer, in France, but you're seeing this struggle. You saw it in Italy, in Sweden, in Hungary, I could go on. Right. And even though you're seeing left parties fight back against far right sentiment, it's still very tight,
right,
everywhere. Right. And I'm not trying to say that the right is wrong. That's not what I'm trying to say here. But far right sentiment and populism is a different story. Mm. And that growing trend is something on the global scale that you're seeing in the microcosm of the US elections and other elections all over the world. And I wonder what that means for the future of democracy.
Well, no, I think that's absolutely right. And look, a lot of people celebrating the results, what it means for democracy in the United States and democracy globally. And crazy was on the ballot. And thankfully, many races where Trump denialist type characters, whether they're running for the Senate or governorships or attorney generals or all manner of things, where essentially most of them lost, apart from maybe ruby red parts of the country. So that's reassuring. But you're right, there's still a large cohort of people that believe these things, and we're not out of the woods yet. And a 50-50 Senate or 51-49 Senate is no great comfort when you consider some of the dark forces that are at play and unleashed, not just in the United States, but you're right, quite rightly point out, around the world. Now, speaking of around the world, Ukraine. In the last 24 hours, we've had this large attack. Yet again, huge missile bombardment of Ukraine by the Russians, pretty much in retaliation to the humiliation of losing the critical city of Kherson over the week. And you see this pattern from Putin where something bad happens. He gets a humiliation, a huge reversal on the battlefield, and then he responds in what I call the military equivalent of a temper tantrum and starts firing missiles. Now, of course, it's horrible what you see, these types of bombardment. But what was unusual about this one, other than the targeting of civilian infrastructure, was that it would appear something has occurred in Poland. Now, we don't know exactly what. There are mixed reports about whether or not it was a missile that landed there or whether it was an accident where the Ukrainians were trying to shoot down a missile. But what we do know is that there wouldn't have been any sort of explosion in Ukraine unless the Russians had fired missiles from somewhere, either inside Ukraine or from Russia or the Black Sea. So what does this mean? You know, a lot of people saw that and were like, okay, NATO's been attacked. We've got Article 5 being invoked of the NATO Treaty, World War III. Is that what's going to happen, or are cooler heads going to prevail here? What do you think?
Well, to sum it up, no, I don't think that we're about to enter World War III. I think the likelihood of that is thankfully right now low, at least. Right. And that's because this was very clearly not a deliberate attack. And I'm not saying that we have to ignore that we should ignore this. On the contrary, we certainly don't want Russia to think that it can get away with anything. Whether it was Russia or not, as you said, it could have been because it could have been, by the way, a damaged missile. It could have been a missile that the Ukrainians tried to target and then set it off course rather than setting it on a different path. Right. So there are many arguments that could be behind this. And so for that reason, an investigation is needed. I would not at all blame Poland for calling for emergency consultations under Article 4 of the NATO Charter. But Article 5, where an attack on one is an attack on all and everybody dives in to go attack the enemy, I just don't see that happening. And I'm curious, you know, I don't know how it's being portrayed in Australia. I know in the United States, the media here just clamored and ran to run to our political officials and say, well, you know, now this has been an attack on NATO territory and it's not on the border. It's a few miles in. So isn't this an attack on all? And I think, you know, we all have to take a deep breath, but I think what this underscores is, as you said, if this war hadn't been happening at all, then you wouldn't face this scenario. And it only highlights the need to bring an end to it as quickly as possible. Right. And so perhaps I'm hopeful, at least, that this encourages NATO and other partners to give everything the Ukrainian military wants to bring this to an end. If they have already proven that they use this military aid very effectively, as evidenced by the retreat from Kherson. That's huge. That is a huge defeat. And you also have all these signs at the same time that the channels of dialogue are still there. The CIA director met with his counterpart, the Russian counterpart in Turkey, warning him against using a nuclear weapon, for example. That happened before this. President Zelensky presented a 10-point peace plan to the G20 that, of course, the Russians rejected. But the point is, there are still these opportunities there. And I'm hopeful that what we just saw shakes everyone to their core and says, all right, you know what? We need to give Ukraine what they need. And we need to press on those dialogues, on those communication channels more heavily.
Right. I agree with you. I mean, the thing that you would hope is that it yet again creates a sense of urgency around weapons supply. Yeah, when I speak to Ukrainians, the frustration from them, and it's, you know, this is from punters on the street to senior officials, they say, well, why does it take something bad to happen for us to get the weapons that we need? And you know, you and I have spoken before that in respect to sanctions, which is that you end up doing the things that you said you wouldn't do, but you do them later when they're less effective. Weapons have not been dissimilar in that, we can't send these weapons and then we do, we can't give HIMARS and then we do. And you know, missile attacks, the technology exists to stop these types of attacks. These missiles can be shot down. It's just a question of Ukraine being armed with the defensive weapons to stop these types of attacks. And then after that, it's giving them the offensive weaponry to be able to expel the Russians from their territory as quickly as possible. And the faster Russia loses, the more likely we either get to a complete total military defeat or a diplomatic defeat, whichever one it is. But this reluctance, it's interesting though, it's not Poland. You know, I went to the Forum 2000 meeting in the Czech Republic in Prague, and the thing that struck me, so I happened to be watching, there was the Czech Prime Minister spoke, and ten in total foreign ministers were there, and in two separate panels from all the, you know, sort of NATO European power countries. There's a perverse thing, which is the smaller you are or the closer you are to Russia, the more bullish you are about military support to the Ukrainians. And it seems counterintuitive in that, well, you think the French and the Germans should be the ones standing up the hardest. But yeah, you know, when you're a small country, you're basically stuffed on your own. You know, I'm a unionist, so strength in numbers. And you know, Lithuania is one of the most forward-leaning, the Polish are the most forward-leaning, and they're calling out the Germans for their delays in giving that assistance. So I think you're right. I think there won't be. I mean, Article 5, I think already we've seen today it's not going to happen, and nor,
you know,
should it.
Misha, I'm curious, by the way, you went to Ukraine a second time. Well, you've been more than that, but you recently went to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Was it very different than, you know, when you went in February, for example? How different? What was different about it in terms of how people felt on the ground? What were they saying? Yeah. Were they more hopeful? Had morale changed? How do they view the aid? I completely agree with you. I mean, like you said, the Eastern Europeans were the first to cut off energy. They are much more willing to sacrifice because they understand the sacrifice, and they understand, they have a deep rooted understanding of the fear of being under Russian rule. So they will do anything to prevent that. Anyway, I've been very curious about your trip. If you could sum up just what was, you know, was there anything different about the sentiment in general?
The biggest difference is that, you know, when I left, I guess the first time, Russia was not winning the war, but Ukraine wasn't losing it either. And so it was this sort of sense of we're not losing and we're still here. And the confidence that came from, you know, we're going to be gone in 24 hours to, we're still here 24 hours, 48 hours, now some nearly 250 days, right? So that confidence is there. But also the battlefront's getting further and further away from the cities where Ukrainians are residing. You know, more places are being liberated. So there's a sense of momentum, a sense of pushing towards victory, and every liberation creates a new sense of lift of morale. And so when you're winning, confidence grows, right? And and it's infectious. You know, I'm fond of saying this, some people that have heard me before, I say that, you know, Napoleon said that morale is worth more than every other factor of war combined. And right now you look at it, the Ukrainians have got it and the Russians don't. And so Ukrainian morale is growing and Russians is falling, and that's going to be the interesting thing over the next phase through winter. And, you know, it's put to me by a lot of people, they always say, which side freezes first will lose. And you know, the Ukrainians got their challenges in heating themselves with all the attacks on their infrastructure, and that is designed to break their morale. But the Russians have got their problems too. They're going to be sitting in the snow a long way from home with poor logistics, poor leadership, getting beaten all over the place. It's not exactly the way you build a happy army. And they're conscripted and they don't want to be there, right? So that will be interesting to see what shape both sides are in into the winter and what sort of fighting is possible. But we could talk about Ukraine all the time. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time. So we got a lot of things we want to talk about. But we spoke about Putin. Now, G20, the communique just went out basically saying, unusual in a way, because they put out a communique. Normally, communiques have to be agreed by all parties. But with Russia being in the political doghouse, completely ostracized, even really by the Chinese, they put out a statement saying nearly all countries agree and condemn Russia's war in Ukraine and its actions, certainly over the last day or so, and generally in the invasion. It appears the Chinese kind of were involved as well, about saying, well, you know, we don't completely agree with all the sanctions, and so there's a little bit of that. But overall, you'd probably say 18 of the 20 countries have given Putin a kick. Now, Putin's not going to give himself a kick. So what do we make of the G20? There was a big meeting between Biden and Xi. What's your take of this really huge meeting in the context of global geopolitics right now?
What a fascinating meeting it was this time. And in the U.S., you have a lot of pundits saying that because of the lack of agreement regarding Russia and on a communique, that it kind of makes the G20 useless, or, you know, what is the point of it anyway? And I find it a very funny even argument to make, because of course it's useful. Of course we need it. I would argue that in the world of the United Nations and the existential crisis the UN is facing and their fecklessness, I don't hide my thoughts on the UN, clearly. Yes. So you need the G20 and the G7 all the more, because those are heads of state talking directly to one another. Right. And there's a lot of value that can come from it. And I tell people all the time, diplomacy includes dealing with unsavory characters. It's why I wasn't a diplomat and why I preferred to just sanction everybody. And
probably why I'm not a diplomat either. I have not a very diplomatic character, I think. But anyway, continue. Yeah.
No, neither. And, you know, and so, but we need it, by the way. That doesn't mean I don't see the value in it. We need it. And so there was a lot of value that came out of the latest G20. And even if they didn't all agree, I did think it was weird. But I'm a little bit of a tough cookie on this one. I did think it was weird to even include Russia altogether. Right. I'm glad that Putin didn't go and that Lavrov went instead. Lavrov never made any kind of political theater. He didn't stand up and run out during any kind of presentations, including Zelensky's video call where he presented this peace plan. Apparently, by the way, allegedly he had chest pains, though. I'm not sure if you heard this.
Yeah,
he had chest
pains. There's a weird thing about him being sick and then they denied it. It's peculiar.
Yes, he may or may not have had chest pains and may or may not have gone to the hospital. We don't know for sure, but there's some smoke there.
It's a strange thing to deny anyway. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. Yeah.
Although, I mean, it's very strongman, right? Like, they can't admit any weakness because, yeah. So anyway, so in terms of the value, I think that, you know, coming from the U.S. perspective, it's to see what came out of the Biden and President Xi meeting to here is being really, I don't want to say celebrated, but lauded. There's a huge sigh of relief. And it is mainly because the channels of communication are open and because it takes everything down a notch. Things had gotten really tense over the last few years, and particularly tense since Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, visited Taiwan a couple months ago. 100%. So, we can dive into that in a second, but on the whole, I think that I'm taking that meeting as representative in general of what they were able to come out with. I don't expect any more over the last few years since Russia first annexed Crimea in 2014. You had this a lot under President Trump when he was president here. We've had a lot of communiques that have not happened or where all the countries have not been able to agree on things like climate change and sanctions and so on. And so I don't even expect it anymore, so long as they're having some kind of valuable conversations. And that's why I point to the Biden-Xi meeting that I wouldn't say means that things are warming up. I would say that things are still chilly outside, but it is not a cold war.
Well, it doesn't appear to be.
Maybe it's all that.
And that's a good thing. I mean, you look at look, it's a similar thing in Australia. Our Prime Minister Anthony Albanese caught up with Xi Jinping on the sidelines. They had a one-on-one meeting for half an hour. That's the first meeting between Xi and an Australian Prime Minister in 6 years. So we've been in the absolute outhouse diplomatically with Chinese, and they're very unhappy with Australia implementing a number of measures to offset Chinese foreign interference. They don't like that we've signed up to AUKUS. They don't like the fact that we didn't let them build the 5G network here, but we had $20 billion worth of sanctions on Australian products, wine, lobsters, various things. Interestingly enough, they had to lower them on coal because they couldn't replace their coal. So ironically, in the end, it's a bit of a capitulation by the Chinese to Australia because Australia found markets for most of its products and didn't really get hurt economically. But in many ways, China injured itself because it's quite reliant. Unlike the rest of the world, which is very reliant on Chinese products, manufactured goods, etc., China's very reliant on Australia's inputs, you know, primary products, iron ore, coking coal, agricultural products. So in many ways, you'd say on a diplomatic basis, a lot of people are very relieved by it. And I think it's good to take the temperature down. Australia has not given up anything either, which is good. I think, you know, when you're the sanctions expert of, you're the expert on everything in this conversation between the two of us. But what the Chinese tend to do is they put these sanctions on, they say they're non-negotiable, and then over time, they kind of just quietly drop them off. And you've seen that happen with the Norwegians, the Canadians and others. So that's a positive from where Australia sits. We're not at a reset, but we're out of the complete and utter freezer of a relationship. And now we're talking, which I think is always a positive to have dialogue. But going back to Biden and Xi, which is kind of the critical relationship, you know, geopolitics in many ways on a one-to-one basis. This is Xi's big first hit out since getting re-elected at the Congress he's now president for life, third term. He's removed term limits on himself, basically grabbed control of the entire party apparatus now as well. At that, he's run out anyone that's not really one of his guys off the Central Committee and other parts. The readout, now we're getting in the weeds here, but the readout I thought was interesting in that there wasn't a lot of that typical stuff you see from the Chinese of, you know, the West must be destroyed and you know, the decadent Western powers are trying to encircle the great rise of China. It was a more conciliatory. Do you agree with that? Do you think overall there was a quest from at least, and maybe now he's re-elected like any politician, he's a politician, he's a dictator, but he's a politician. He's re-elected and now are you seeing maybe he's trying to dial it down himself as well, parking up what the Americans are trying to do?
You know, it's interesting because you're right. He was without all that bombastic, rhetoric. When he won the third term and he gave a speech at the Congress, the Chinese Communist Party Congress a few weeks ago, He said that stormy seas were ahead, quote unquote, stormy seas were ahead, and that he had successfully pushed back against Western bullying. And, you know, so giving this kind of very ominous tone, very much China the superpower and so on. And that's not the tone he struck in Bali. Who knows? Maybe it's the energy of the, you know, the honeymooners in the air. It softened him up a little bit.
Aussies. The drunken Aussies.
Yeah, right. Probably. But to me, I saw it as evidence of the fact that you have two leaders that if the two countries actually did run into conflict, two really powerful countries, two of the most powerful armies in the world, you're talking about devastation that we can't even think about. And there seemed to be this desire for stability on both sides. And I know, at least from the White House readout, what they said was that President Biden said to President Xi that we would always be competitive, that we would always seek to compete with China in a whole wide range of areas, but that doesn't mean that it necessarily needs to land in conflict. And of course, he shared his concerns on the human rights abuses against the Uyghurs and Tibet and Hong Kong. So he went through the talking points, of course, and Taiwan, it's unclear what the conclusion was, other than that we know that Biden said we want things to be to remain as the status quo. And China said, Taiwan is a red line for us and we don't want to see it crossed. And what I took that to mean was that they don't want the United States or anybody else officially declaring Taiwan's independence. And anyway, by the way, I don't see that happening anytime soon. Right. And so, you know, they can all just kind of like when you talk about, and I do this a lot too, where I sometimes view these leaders as big toddlers. You know, they need to have their bottle of milk and take a nap and take a breath and realize that that having things simmer that much serves no side. It doesn't serve either interest. And I think that seeing them express that, basically saying that they are going to disagree, but they need to coexist, and therefore the channels of communication need to stay open, that is a relief. That does not mean I don't think that the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese regime will not remain the biggest national security threat. I think they will. I do believe that now, and I think that will remain for the coming future. But that in and of itself makes it so that, you know, we can take a breath. Yeah. We can all get on the same page.
I agree with you. It doesn't change any of the underlying fundamentals, but it does take away the increased risk of a crisis point. Yeah, you know, and I think mm-hmm. that's important because, you know, crisis points, as we saw in Ukraine, they can become unpredictable, and brinkmanship can very easily fall into conflict. And so, you know, I think positives have come out of that for the first time in some time. They're you know, not to use an over term, you know, green shoots, you know, in the diplomatic world, perhaps. Now, speaking of what may have been green shoots, but and dictators and overgrown toddlers, Iran, this is mm-hmm. an issue that has got a lot of attention, but maybe not enough attention. We've seen
definitely not
incredible protesters, essentially led by very brave women and young brave women standing up to the regime there and its oppression of everyone, but particularly women's rights, minority rights. Now, where do you see this at now? Because we just had this it's been contested whether it's true, but there was 15,000 people we know have been arrested essentially for crimes against the state as protesters. So it's a classic kind of autocratic crackdown. Yeah, we see that, you know, it's a classic playbook, but then there were reports a lot of these people are going to be sentenced to death. Now, subsequently, maybe that's not the case, but the fact is some have already been sentenced to death. So where do you see this at now, and what's next, and what should the world be doing?
That's right. So as of now, five individuals have been sentenced to death for charges linked to the protests. And some of these charges are things like being a quote unquote enemy of God, or being a quote unquote corrupt to the earth. So, you know, a translation that doesn't fit perfectly. And apparently there are 20 more that could be charged with similar crimes that call for a death sentence. And listen, this is all a ploy for the Iranian regime to instill fear in its people, because because the protests continue, and they continue across the country in strong numbers. And the sheer bravery, every time I think that something, that someone does something brave or outstanding, the next day someone does something even more brave. So for example, I saw today that you had this couple on a busy street in Shiraz, and they're kissing in the middle of the street, and the woman is wearing jeans and a top and her hair's out, and they're kissing, and they took the photo, and the photo goes viral. You have young Iranians who are running up to clerics across the country and knocking their turbans off their head. And the argument, I saw this one activist said that their argument was, if women couldn't decide what they could wear, then the clerics don't have that choice either. They can't decide what they get to wear either. But that's just the bravery here. And right. So anyway, so you see these protests continue, even in the face of these brutal crackdowns. Like you said, 15,000 arrested. You have 300 to 350 who have died so far. And yet they're still out there. And so the Iranian regime is trying to do two things. One, they're trying to instill the fear of God, which is what all authoritarian regimes do, by upping the ante and saying now they're going to be executing people linked to these protests, giving these death sentences. And on the other hand, by the way, they're trying to distract the world a little bit. So there was news today, for example, that the Iranian security forces struck a vessel owned by an Israeli billionaire in the Gulf of Oman. And we've seen also banter that they might strike US bases in Iraq, for example, things like this, of this nature. And so they're, on one hand, they're trying to instill fear and they're trying to distract everybody else. And to be fair, I do think everyone else is distracted. And I don't think it's because of that. I think it's because of all the other, listen to what we just ran through for the week.
It's just congested, right?
Yes. We've touched every single major national security issue, all the priorities we talked about, right? Growing populism, Russia, China, right. Now Iran. These are all the most major topics, and they're all happening. They're all on fire in 1 week. And they are distracted. But to be honest with you, in the U.S., I can tell you, because as you know, from my life is the news. And so I have to see the news from everywhere. And I find in Europe, they are covering the Iran protests very intensely. The regular lay person knows what's going on in Iran on a day-to-day basis. And you do not see that in the United States at all. And there was a flare up at the beginning, but now, you know, a lot of people don't even know if the Iran protests are continuing. And unfortunately, I think that's, some of that is the media, of course, but a lot of that is also the US government. And the US government is not, in my opinion, is not out there strongly enough on this. They are not seizing the opportunity that is there in front of them to side more strongly with the Iranian people and further undermine the regime.
Let me ask you this. I mean, do you see potential for the end of the regime in these protests, or are they going to get a handle on it? Like, or is it in play?
That's such a good question. The answer, I think, is yes and no. So let's drill down very briefly. I won't talk too long, since yes and no is such a vague response.
But it's a great answer.
I know. The fact is that, unfortunately, so listen, I handled the Syria crisis for the first 2 years when I was working at the National Security Council at the White House. And the way the Iranian regime is responding to protests is out of the authoritarian playbook. And unfortunately, they have not at all pulled out their big cards yet. And so it can get much uglier if they wanted to. The Iranian regime is what taught the Syrian regime how to respond to protests. So we know what they're used to and what they're capable of. And so the answer quickly is that I don't see the regime falling right now or in the very near future. But the fact is that Iranian citizens can't turn back now. It is a completely different sense of fearlessness that did not exist in previous protests that you had in 2019. By the way, the anniversary of those is now in November. Or protests even in 2009 when you had the Green Revolution. Right. So you now have a sense of fearlessness, and that spans across all socioeconomic backgrounds in Iran, across the whole country, across all different kind of ethnic backgrounds in Iran. it's a very different game now for the regime, that if they don't make certain concessions and freedoms, if they don't at least, and even then, I don't think it's going to be enough, but if they don't start making some kind of reforms, and I don't expect them to, then this is going to be a very long fight. And I do think that in the long run, given Iran's history and proof of how they protest, how they are able to revolutionize, I just think that it's, and I hope I'm not idealistic, but I think it's the beginning of the end, but it could be very slow and it could be very painful.
Well, we watch, I guess, in anticipation and also horror, but my heart goes out to the brave people of Iran. And, there's nothing braver than standing up to an authoritarian regime, knowing that you're quite likely facing death. And it's different to what you're seeing in Ukraine, but very much the same struggle.
It's remarkable.
Good luck to them. Now, one last quick topic before we get to our John Dory's, because, again, in a congested week, they've had COP27 going on.
I almost forgot about that one.
Right. I know. It's just incredible. But quickly, do you see that as progress on climate change, not progress on climate change, status quo? What's the outcome out of that, do you think?
Is my answer. Which was my answer last year too, when for COP26. And so, you have the biggest contentious item on the agenda this round was whether richer, more industrialized nations, the largest polluters around the world, should compensate poorer nations that suffer the most from climate disasters but contribute the least in their carbon footprint. And this year, unlike past years, they actually discussed it. So the view of at least the United States was, we're not going to get in the way of this discussion. Europe said that they support this kind of compensation, which is great, except that they're not they are not the biggest polluters. Actually, the top polluters are, in order, the China by far the most, then the United States, India. India, Russia, Germany, Iran. I might have those last few ones mixed up in order, but these are the top, the top polluters. And so Germany's in there, I guess, but this has been a contentious issue with no conclusion other than that they're going to continue financing projects that mitigate climate related disasters and technology that could help poorer nations, so that they don't hit them as hard. But I haven't seen for the crisis that we're facing, and the way I thought the UN Secretary General, for all that I criticize him for, I thought he summed it up very well when he said that we were on the road to climate hell, something like that. And our foot is on the accelerator. That's what he said. And he's absolutely right. But I don't see still not enough of urgency coming out of this summit, given that characterization.
Yeah, it's one of the classic problems. You got two problems, which is a collective action problem. This whole, we all got to do it together, and the incentives to cheat in that collective action problem, and some of the players and, the types of regimes that they are, there's no transparency in them. So there's that. And then there's also the competition with the immediate, right? The important gets pushed out by the urgent with climate change. And it's hard to disagree when you see what's happening here right in Australia. We've got floods yet again. So the amount of floods are just the extreme weather events the once in 100-year events that are happening with regularity, wildfires, et cetera, around the world is enormously concerning. So maybe COP28, hopefully not COP50. If we get to COP50 and there's no action, then I think we're all stuffed. John Dory this week, what do you got for me? What is the story?
All right. Well, I have been very interested by, incensed by the stories coming out of Qatar in the run-up to the World Cup. And have been following this for a while. And I'm not sure why I expected Qatar to come around, but have been really, truly shocked by some of the statements coming out. So you've had Qatar's World Cup ambassador, one of them. So an individual whose sole job is to sell the World Cup, to be Qatar's face for the World Cup, said that said in the context of individuals, gay individuals, people from the LGBTQ plus community being concerned about going to Qatar because homosexuality is banned there. There have been hotels that already weeks ago were saying that they weren't sure they were going to be accepting gay couples. The answer on that is not very clear because both the Qataris and FIFA have been going back and forth on that, changing their tune. But the point is, there's been a lot of concern about this issue, obviously. And so there's been a lot of, the Qataris feel very attacked. And so the World Cup ambassador for Qatar said that homosexuality is damage, quote, damage in the mind. And which is so appalling and so offensive, I don't even know where to begin. And then you had other Qatari officials saying that, you know, why is the world beating up on them? This is how things are there. And everyone should respect their rules. And the fact is that without them realizing it, they are excluding everybody. They're excluding a huge chunk of people for a sport that is meant to be very inclusive. Right. And by the way, FIFA is not helping. Given that the run-up to this World Cup games...
I mean, honestly, I mean...
No, I know. Well, I mean, you
FIFA
would think with all this...
FIFA is the worst organization. You want to talk about how bad the UN is. FIFA, you know, they had a heavy dose of corruption on top of the dysfunction. But anyway, so continue.
Yes, it's. I mean, the run-up to these games has been so controversial. You've had Qatar's human rights abuses of migrant workers were needed to build, yes, the stadiums and infrastructure and hotels needed for this event. Yes, and at least 6,500 migrants died while doing this.
It's an unbelievable thing.
It's unbelievable. It's disgusting and revolting. And they promised to make reforms. They really didn't do much. Then you had the banter about the corruption and corruption that had been proven, that FIFA officials were bribed to award the World Cup to both Qatar and Russia at the time. So you've got the corruption scandals. Now you've got these scandals. And the fact is that they just keep digging themselves further in that hole, both in terms of what they say, because they're angry, they're like petulant toddlers, of course, as usual. And then FIFA put out a letter telling the 32 competing teams to just focus on the football, quote, focus on the football, that this is not the place, this sport is not the place to get dragged into political and ideological, quote, battles, and that the sport is not there to hand out moral lessons.
But it's funny, though, right?
It's just appalling.
No, but there's irony here, because the Australian team actually put out a video critiquing Qatar for all the sorts of things you just mentioned there. But there's a reason why these regimes want the sport, because they want to sport wash themselves, right? So Putin wanted, had his big triumphant World Cup in 2018. It's appalling that it ever went there, but he wanted it as a propaganda event. Likewise, Qatar are hoping to showcase their regime or their country using the platform of the game. So you can't, on the one hand, say this is a great platform for us to project ourselves, but don't query any of the things that we don't want to talk about, right? It's, and I think... the problem is with regimes like that is they're so used to propaganda at home, they expect propaganda internationally. And that is where they bump up against reality, right? And so, you know, you see that with the Chinese, the Russians and others. And I think the Qataris are getting mugged by reality here, that they're not just a place that people fly through on an airline, and now they're getting a lot of scrutiny that they perhaps weren't bargaining for when they first bid for the games, or when they first bribed their way to victory. I mean, it's absurd that they've got it. They now have it, but... you know, FIFA and the IOC as well are just as bad in terms of awarding these events to countries that shouldn't have them. And so this really has to be a line in the sand in terms of the last last event that gets given to a regime or a country like this, because it's unacceptable. Mine is... I am enjoying, and now this is a man very dear to my heart, and I know you have great affection for him, but my favorite wanker billionaire... Elon Musk and the the bonfire of the self-vanities that appears to be going on there at Twitter, where he quite literally appears to be setting $44 billion on fire. It's extraordinary. And what is going on there is like a personal meltdown as well as a company meltdown. And look, you know, I'm a heavy user of Twitter, as you are no doubt, and it's got tons of problems and needs to be fixed. But, I'm enjoying it, because my biggest critique of billionaires is... because they're good at one thing, they believe they're good at all things. And Elon's here to save us from everything. And, I got to say, given it already appears to be not worth nearly as much as he paid for it, it's I'm enjoying it at the very least. I'm sure all the people that have been fired unceremoniously from there are enjoying that too. So I don't know what your take on that is, mate, but...
It's just unbelievable. I don't understand why somebody would go in somewhere and burn the place to the ground. This isn't... You know, this isn't a failing company that a private equity firm needs to go take over, fire everybody, and streamline costs and then sell again. But yet he acts that way. And I don't know if it's some kind of self-hating, chauvinistic, you know, masochistic effort on his part. I really don't understand it, to be honest with you. It's weird. No, it's weird because
he himself on into it. It was peculiar because I was sort of watching him. And you know, a lot of people get Twitter can make you crazy if you spend too much time on there. And he almost egged himself. It's like Trumpian in a way. You know, like Trump is like fueled by his own psychosis, and he kind of just sort of like, you know, eggs himself on. And Musk is a little bit similar in that he's like, oh, I might buy Twitter. And everyone's like, oh, you can't buy Twitter. Oh, I might buy Twitter then. And it just became this self sort of fulfilling thing that, and he bought it without any great plan apart from something that would appear to be written on a napkin. And so, you know, it's a little bit of like, you know, to use the Trump analogy, say, I alone can fix Twitter, you know, and, you know, I'm enjoying it, if nothing else.
I mean, listen, it's a soap opera, right? We're watching this unfold. But the thing that is so shocking is that this has real ramifications, right? Aside from the people who are getting fired by email at the last minute, which is, it's awful. And in the thousands of people.
It's appalling, right? Yeah.
It's appalling. And he didn't follow the rules, by the way, in the United States. If you're going to fire that many people, you have to give the U.S. government a heads up, because the U.S. government has to be prepared for all these people probably applying for unemployment. Sure. And he never did that. Right. Not that I think he's going to get dinged for this, but he never did that. He doesn't care. And that is what's so Trumpian about it, right? He's burning the place down. He doesn't care. And there is not just the real ramifications on people, but all social media platforms play a role and should play a role in democracy and in free speech and in figuring out, they are all trying to figure out how to regulate and how to support, how to not be exploited by criminals and so on, and what their role should be. And I just don't see him helping in any way, shape or regard on that front. I see him just, you know, I don't know if he's going to go sink with the ship. I don't know if that was his goal and he wants, and I can't get into his psyche. I really can't.
It's a dangerous and dark place to be, I think. The less time you spend in Elon Musk's head, it doesn't look like a fun place to be if I look at Elon Musk, so I wouldn't advise it. But anyway, look, as ever, a ripping chat. We've gone over time, I think, as we always do. But look, thanks so much. Good to chat with you. Good to see you. Get the plug in for Oh My World, which is still fantastic. And I know I've been appearing on there for you, so thank you. But
you are so kind. Thank you so much. So I host every week a show on YouTube called Oh My World, where I cover the top world news stories and geopolitical events in a really fun and easy way and in a satirical way, which means that I impersonate a lot of world leaders, which means that I'm often in wigs with bad accents and just as I love it. And I have a lot of fun with it. It's once a week, 10 minutes, because it's meant for a very a viewer who has a short attention span, just like me. And it's fun. So please check it out on YouTube and on Instagram.
Well, yeah, there you go. So if you've been listening and you've been really leaning in when Hagar's speaking and ignoring me and fast forwarding, then you can get more of that by tuning into Oh My World. It's really great. So, 10 minutes rather than this long-winded conversation seems like the right antidote for the world. So look, thanks so much. Catch you next time, mate.
Thank you so much, Misha. It's been great. It was great to see you, and we really covered a lot.
G'day, Diplomates fans. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Hagar, so much fun. She's so smart. Makes me look like an absolute dunce. But if you are enjoying that, check in the show notes. Oh My Show, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter. You'll find her wherever you get your information or your content from. Now, questions come from Andrew. Andrew's asking me, is Joe Biden going to run in 2024? I think that's a really interesting question. I think with Trump running, the increased chances of that are yes. I think basically Biden sees himself quite rightly as the Trump slayer, and he's got a big data point to support that. He's the guy that beat him in 2020. If Biden doesn't think that Trump's going to succeed, then I think it's less likely. Now, the big question in all this is that he's an old man, good call for what it is, and if he gets elected a second time, he'd be 82 years of age when he was sworn in, and that is just really, really old. Goes without saying, this is nothing against Joe Biden. I actually love him. Anyone that listens to this show knows that I'm a huge supporter of Biden and was a big pusher of his candidacy in 2015 even, and as much as, and certainly in 19 and 20. So I think if Biden thinks that the country is safe, and I think there's evidence to support that now, given what's happened in the midterms, I think that's a big boost to Biden's presidency, but to democracy generally, the Democratic Party. And so I think if he thinks it's in good hands, I think he's less likely to run. But who's to say? A lot to come. And we covered the what's happening on the Republican side in the chat with Hagar. But I think that's the big thing I'd be watching for is, does Biden believe democracy is in peril? Is the soul of the nation in peril? If he truly believes so, he'll run. But I think if he was not to run, it'd be interesting to see what happens there. We can talk about that some other time. But I think history is going to judge him very kindly as having pushed Trump out, saved the Republic. He's got he had a big agenda. There's so many things that he's done in terms of the infrastructure bill, the Build Back Better, or the Inflation Reduction Act, the chips bill in terms of reshoring chips into the United States, a whole host of things that he's achieved. Is really kind of, frankly, ahead of what Obama did, frankly, ahead of what Clinton has done. And so he's rightly can be very proud of what he's achieved in 2 years and whatever remains of his presidency, if it's 2 or 6 more years. So anyway, long answer there. But I think there's a gravitational pull between Trump and Biden, and that will determine the outcome. So thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already done so, please rate and review the podcast. It really helps. Share it with your friends. And otherwise, I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.